It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. In 1976, the most famous Soviet dissident in the world moved to a tiny town in rural Vermont. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, Nobel laureate, after years of prison, interrogation, labor camps, internal exile, KGB raids, took his wife and young sons and settled in Cavendish, Vermont, population 1,264-ish. For the people of Cavendish, hiding the world's most famous dissident was a big responsibility.
Every town needs to have a secret that unites them in that secret. And for our town, it was Solzhenitsyn and not giving directions to his home.
Margot Caulfield runs the Cavendish Historical Society.
He moved here in 1976 and he left in 1994. He lived 18 of the 20 years he was in exile here. Literally bought the house sight unseen. It is an absolutely perfect location, and I often think what a gift the people of Cavendish gave him, because he was able to write. Everybody left him alone, and everybody protected his privacy. You know, the kids loved, if somebody would stop and say, how do we get to Solzhenitsyn's? You're going to be three towns over before you realize the kids were having you on. But that's really how the town felt. I mean, the KGB was here. There's no joke about that. They were dressed in a way that no Vermonter would dress, you know, much nicer looking in the dead of winter. You know you're not from Cavendish. Interestingly, the woman that ran the post office at the time, her family was from a part of Poland, and she said, some days we were Russian, some days we were Polish. So she spoke Russian, but she could tell. So people would come into the post office and they would speak Russian and not realizing that she could understand them. I've heard from a number of people. And then there was that time, remember, when the Russian government was sending people around, sort of in a glasnost type of thing. They were trying to go around to schools and speak about Russia and so forth. And they happened to pick Green Mountain Union High School. And two of the Solzhenitsyn kids were there who basically stood up and spoke to them in Russian. As we proverbially say, ripped them a new one.
Eventually, the Soviet Union collapsed and Solzhenitsyn returned to Russia. But the house in Cavendish is still there, and it still belongs to his family, and to this day, no one in town will tell you where it is.
You know, Vermonters are an interesting breed. You know, you do what you need to do, and as long as you pay your taxes and don't cause a normal amount of behavior, they just leave you be.
Today on To the Best of Our Knowledge, our subject is, surprise, not Russian defectors or New England's small towns. It's resilience. The kind of resilience that lets people survive and even thrive in the face of hardship and sweeping life changes. We're going through a lot of that right now. And here's the good news. You were born with one of the most resilient brains on the planet. Biologically engineered to respond and adapt to everything life throws at you. And we know that thanks to something else that happened in Cavendish, a freak accident that changed the history of brain science and the life of a young man. His name was Phineas Gage.
Can I just take a picture?
Sure.
As Steve and I are poking around the museum Margot Caulfield runs, it's a former church turned into a repository of Victorian china and silverware, wooden school desks, mysterious farm implements.
This poster was found, and we blew it up so people can really read it. On the 13th of September, 1848, Mr. Gates was engaged in blasting a rock in Cavendish, Vermont, on the line of the Rutland and Burlington Railroad when a premature explosion took place, which forced an iron bar, I like that, completely through his head.
But just to put this in perspective, the rod that went through his head was, 3.5 feet long and nearly 2 inches in diameter, or 1.5 inches in diameter. We're talking a very big rod that shot straight through his head.
Right.
What's this?
This is a replica of the tamping rod. The real tamping rod would have been longer. So which end do you think went in first?
I would assume the pointed end, but you're going to tell me not, right?
No, it was the pointed end. If it had been the other way, we wouldn't be having this conversation. We would not be having this conversation.
News of the accident traveled all over the world. Phineas Gage became famous as the man who survived having his skull run through with an iron tamping rod.
You're all lucky.
It's not just that Phineas Gage survived the accident that nearly killed him. His case led doctors for the first time to link psychology, behavior, personality to specific areas in the brain. This small town in Vermont is basically where neuroscience was born.
So that's the boarding house where he lived, right?
Wait, which
there.
One is? Right there.
The rundown one. Incredibly beat up, rundown one with the porch is entirely full of trash.
Yes.
Wow.
And you're going to come to an underpass. Keep on going around.
Keep on going.
Cavendish has seen better days. But in 1848, things were looking good. Gold was discovered in California. The first women's rights convention was held in Seneca Falls. Democratic revolutions were happening all over Europe. And even more important,
if you look to the right, you'll see some train tracks kind of covered in the woods. But there they are.
The railroad was coming to town.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Encourage anybody to walk on the train tracks because this is a working rail line.
Oh, it's still used.
Oh, yeah. It was a really big deal what was going on here, and people would have really noticed it and been, bring on that railroad.
And they definitely would have noticed the attractive young construction foreman.
Phineas was 25 years of age. He was in excellent health. He was considered to be of medium build for his town. He was extremely well-liked by his employees as well as his employer.
On September 13th, Phineas and his crew were working south of the village, right about here.
And if you look down, you'll see the outcropping out there, which is where they would have been blasting. So what they would do is they would come out here, and as you see, there are these outcrops here, these big rocks that they had to get out of the way to make it possible for the train to get through these big cuts. So they would bore a hole, they would put the powder in, and they put it in as deeply as they could, lay a fuse in, fill it full of sand, and the sand is to really tap it in there because you want that really deep in there because when it would explode, it would give you the best bang for the buck. Big, you want it so it really cleared a lot of gravel rock out of the way. And either he was completely distracted or the assistant wasn't doing what he was supposed to be doing, but basically the sand didn't get put in. He turned his head, maybe he was talking, and so as soon as that tamping rod, that metal, hit the gunpowder boom, that caused the explosion, and it went under his left cheek and right out of the top of the head. He was thrown back on the gun, and he kind of convulsed a few times, and then he sat up.
Wait, he sat up?
He sat up maybe a minute or so. He kind of sat up, and he was kind of amazed. the tamping rod was covered with gray matter and blood, and, you know, it's kind of a mess.
With his brain, is what you're saying.
Yes. Some of his workers tried to clean it off. Today we'd be like, don't touch that. That's forensic evidence. And they put him on an ox cart. And they followed the same path that we followed coming out here. They took him back into his hotel room.
Wasn't he in excruciating pain?
He would have definitely been in pain, but the worst part was he was throwing up. And every time he would throw up, brain matter is...
would come out of the top of his head, out of the hole in his head.
Yeah.
Wow.
I know, this is pretty graphic. Sorry. But hold on, because Dr. Harlow is on the way.
When Harlow gets there, Harlow...
Wait, explain who Harlow is. Who gets there?
Dr. Harlow, who really is the really amazing treating physician that takes care of him throughout all this and documents it, and it's why we know this case today. By the time he gets there at 6 p.m., I don't know how graphic we want to get here.
Oh, go for it.
Go for it. So he not only had a opening at the top, you've got this weeping coming from the other end, and basically Harlow sort of followed the trajectory by taking one finger going up and one finger going down till they met in the middle.
Wait, you're saying he could put his fingers through his head and touch his finger? Good God.
Yeah. You know, how many times, we don't know how many times Harlow was like, do you feel this? Do you feel that? You know, I hate to even have that. But
I'm just thinking, no sterile gloves either.
At least Harlow, he actually, in his training, practiced what was called aseptic technique, where you actually washed your hands somewhat. But Gage was very sick. It wasn't long, for fortunately he lapsed into a coma. His family was called. They came down. They built the coffin. The family had made up their mind. They had his clothes picked out, the coffin made. They were good to go. And they weren't really thrilled that Harlow was going to go ahead and say, no, no, I can handle this, which Harlow did.
It was a long and gruesome recovery. I'll spare you the details. But Gage did eventually heal. He lost one eye, and he had a permanent hole in his skull, covered by a thin layer of skin. He was a medical marvel. But he wasn't the same.
And this is when Harlow really begins to document the changes in him.
Before the accident, Phineas was a favorite with the railroad company. Now they reported he was fitful, volatile, disrespectful. He indulged, their words, in the grossest profanity.
People with the type of injury he had will often have rage, and I'm sure he was difficult.
Even his friends said Gage is no longer Gage. His mother wrote to relatives asking for help. And Marco says all that fits the pattern of traumatic brain injury.
Based on my own experience with people that have had similar types of injury, you can talk to them and they sound completely cogent. And then you talk to them another time and you're like, what planet are they on? And they can become extremely angry, but because they have these periods where they seem completely fine and normal, people really get angry with them and believe that they somehow or other they've got total control over the faculties when they don't. And this is the horror of traumatic brain injury. Some families just cannot handle a patient like that.
Harlow, on the other hand, was fascinated by the changes. There was a long-running debate at the time about whether different regions in the brain govern different behaviors. And here was a case of severe damage to the frontal lobe, followed by a dramatic personality shift. It seemed like a no-brainer.
And it laid the pathwork that you see the first real brain surgery done in 1885, the way that we think of it today. But it opened up a whole new horizon that you can sustain a brain injury, you can survive it, you can touch the brain, which means you can do surgery. It's huge. It's really, really huge.
Meanwhile, this new version of Phineas Gage had physically recovered. He was strong, still a young man, and he needed a job. For a while, he made money exhibiting himself around New England as a curiosity.
He would literally go in and you got to see the bar and you did that and he'd bend down and you could watch his brain pulse, sort of like watching a baby's, you know, before the fontanelles closed.
But he didn't want to be some sideshow freak. And then somehow he was offered a job as a long-distance stagecoach driver on the Valparaiso-Santiago route in Chile. It was a 100-mile route, 13 hours, handling a coach and 6 horses, plus passengers. The terrain was rough. There were revolutionaries in the hills. He did it for 7 years.
He was constantly surrounded by different languages because this is a protocol. You had an English speaking, you had Spanish, you had Portuguese, you had all these different languages, so he was hearing this. He had to memorize a route.
It doesn't sound like a job for a guy who was supposedly antisocial, volatile, incapable of focusing on anything for very long, and emotionally unpredictable. So how did he do it?
One of the things that we know that helps you hold on, because your brain is always sending you these new neurons, and today when we talk about neuroplasticity and how you use that to recorrect the pathways, or people talk about rewiring the brain, so you can see where just the lifestyle he had of constant new things are constantly giving him new experiences. So those new neurons as they're firing have something to stay around for.
In 1860, Phineas Gage began to have epileptic seizures. His health failed, and he went home to his mother. He died that May, 12 years after the iron rod entered his skull. Today, Phineas Gage's case is legendary. Entire books have been written about it. It's a staple of introductory classes in psychology, neuroscience, philosophy. But over the years, it's been interpreted differently. For a long time, people focused on, and maybe even exaggerated, his personality changes. There are stories that he lived rough in Chile, that he was a brawling, foul-mouthed drifter, that he drank himself to death. Today, he seems more like a model of rehabilitation and recovery.
Even well after the accident, after he had been healed, a lot of medical authorities just didn't believe it. It had to be verified.
It did, and of course, the final verification came from Harlow, who continually persevered and was able to obtain his skull, and he brought it back and held it up to the Mass Medical Society and said, "Here you go, folks."
Wait, this is his skull. So this was well after he died, then?
Yeah. Oh, no, they got that while he was dead. No.
Wow.
But after he died, Harlow never let this go.
And what about for you? What does this story mean to you?
I am fascinated what he overcame to survive for as long as he did. The resiliency piece of his story fascinates me, which is also a big part of the Solzhenitsyn story, is resiliency. I think it's just hardwired into our DNA, but you know, everybody right now is so worried about COVID and what the long term, oh, we're all gonna be deranged humans at the end. Well, you know, that's just not true. Humans in our DNA, we're wired to do some pretty horrific stuff, but we also are extraordinarily resilient, so I'm not worried about it.
Before we left, Marco showed us a photograph of Phineas. It's one of only 2 taken after the accident. You can see the scar on his cheek and the missing eye. But he's young, vital, handsome, well-dressed. Call it Portrait of Human Resilience. Thanks to Margot Caulfield, director of the Cavendish Historical Society in Cavendish, Vermont, for sharing his story. Neuroscience has come a long way since Phineas Gage. But the more people study the brain, the more parts they find in it. And at this point, it kind of seems like inside your head, there's not just one person. There's a whole team.
Each cell in your brain is as complicated as the state of Wisconsin. Every cell in your brain has the entire human genome in it. It's trafficking millions of proteins around in extremely complicated biochemical cascades. Each neuron in your head is mind-bogglingly complex, and you got 86 billion of these. So What we're talking about is an entire cosmos in there. So when we say something just, oh, you're just a bunch of neurons, we're sort of sweeping all that under the rug and then saying, well, that sounds silly that you're a bunch of neurons. But in fact, you are a whole cosmos of your inner life in there. And so in theory, you could read out somebody's brain. I mean, I think this is a long way off, maybe 300 years or something. But in theory, every experience you've had is getting mapped and stored into your brain. All of these things represent your view, your history in the world.
Neuroscientist David Eagleman on the new frontiers of brain science, next. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. From Wisconsin Public Radio. And PRX. I don't know about you, but I'm starting to forget what daily life was like before the pandemic. I mean, we've all been through so much, and it's changed us, literally. Your brain is not the same now as it was before COVID, and David Eagleman says that's actually a good thing. Eagleman is a neuroscientist at Stanford. He's also a novelist. He was the science advisor for the HBO series Westworld. And he told Steve Paulson, our brains are far more plastic and resilient than we realize. He calls it live-wired, which is also the title of his new book.
Every moment of your life, your brain is rewiring. You know, you've got 86 billion neurons and about a fraction of a quadrillion connections between those. And what I think is hard to appreciate is that every moment of your life, these vast seas of connections are constantly changing. They're changing their strength. They're unconnecting and reconnecting elsewhere. It's why you are a slightly different person than you were a week ago or a year ago. Every memory that you make, when you learn, for example, that my name is David, there's a physical change in the structure of your brain. That's what it means to remember something.
So are these just tiny little changes that are happening constantly, or can significant rewiring go on, I don't know, over the course of a week, for instance?
Yeah, it's both. So there's tiny changes happening all the time. Of course, there are times when we have bigger changes going on. Actually, right now during COVID is a time when everyone has lots of changes going on because suddenly we find ourselves kicked off the hamster wheel. In other words, we were optimized at doing whatever we were doing before, and now we're having to really rethink things and relearn things and be creative about things. So this is, by the way, the only silver lining to this lockdown is the fact that we're getting a lot of brain plasticity out of it.
I mean, that's fascinating. I mean, you're saying there is such a thing as COVID brain. Our brains are probably different now, maybe substantially different because of the pandemic.
Yeah, that's right. I hadn't heard the expression COVID brain, but what is happening to those of us who have not caught the illness is a sort of beneficial COVID brain. We get to really challenge ourselves with novelty. And this is the most important thing for the brain. You know, there are these studies that actually have been running for a few decades now. For example, there's one with nuns who live in a convent their whole lives. and they agreed to donate their brains upon their death. And so at autopsy, what the researchers discovered was that some fraction of these nuns had Alzheimer's disease, but nobody knew it when they were alive. And the reason, it turns out, is because they were constantly challenging themselves. They lived with a bunch of other sisters in these convents. They had responsibilities, they had chores, they dealt with each other all the time, which is, by the way, one of the most challenging things for the brain is other people, in a good way. And so what happened is, till the day they died, they were cognitively active. And so even though their brains were physically getting chewed up by the disease, they were constantly building new roadways in the brain from A to B and C to D and so on. And as a result, they didn't have the cognitive deficits that typically go with Alzheimer's. The contrasting situation is when somebody retires and their lives shrink and they sit on a couch and watch Jerry Springer and they lose, they don't have many friends anymore. And that turns out to be really the worst thing you can do for your brain.
Okay, so there's a silver lining here to coronavirus. But on the other hand, so many people are having so much trouble right now. And I'll just tell you, I mean, just from personal experience, for at least the first few months of the lockdown, I had a really hard time really focusing my attention. Like I, for whatever reason, I could not read a long, challenging book for months.
This is what happened with absolutely everybody. My friends couldn't even listen to an hour-long podcast or things like that. So I started thinking about that, especially during those first couple of weeks of lockdown, which were very worrisome to everybody. And what I realized is that our ability to think forward in large windows maps on exactly to Maslow's hierarchy of needs. If you remember this, you know, Maslow said, look, you need to take care of things at the lowest level first. You need to get food and shelter and water and so on. Then once you have that, you move up the pyramid and at the very top is self-actualization as a person. And what I realized is, when you are worried about food and water, specifically, you know, how am I going to get food into my fridge for my family? How am I going to get toilet paper for my bathroom? This sort of thing, which everyone was worried about at the beginning, then you can't think very far forward.
So I want to come back to this idea of brain plasticity. You say there is a constant battle going on inside our brains between different sets of neurons. They're sort of constantly fighting with each other over who gets control over certain parts of the brain. Can you explain what's going on?
In the last 20 years, I have really started to understand the brain in this way, where there is a competition at all levels going on, all the way down to the individual neurons. And in fact, if you look at a forest, if you walk through a forest, it all looks so serene and beautiful. But in fact, it's the exact same thing happening there. All the plants and trees and shrubs are in competition with each other. They're all competing for sunlight. They're all fighting with each other to stay alive. And that's actually exactly what's going on with neurons. And what I realized is if you take this perspective, it explains a lot of stuff. Just as an example, anytime a part of the brain is going unused, it gets taken over very rapidly by other parts of the brain.
Really? What would be an example of that?
So an example is if somebody goes blind. The area of the brain that we call the visual cortex, it's at the back of the brain. And we always think of that as, oh, that's the part of your brain where you're doing all the vision, all the seeing. But if you go blind, in fact, if we even just blindfold you tightly and stick you in a scanner for a little while, we'll start to see that other areas like touch and hearing start encroaching on that area that we think of as the visual cortex. And for somebody who's born blind, that whole area, the back of the brain, is used for completely different things. Like I said, touch, hearing, memorizing vocabulary words, all these sorts of things.
You have this sort of fascinating bit of speculation that maybe the reason that we dream is to make sure that we have visual imagery in the brain. I mean, otherwise, basically, the world is going dark 12 hours a day, and we might actually lose the ability to see if we didn't dream.
Exactly right. So what I started really thinking about was this issue about as the planet rotates into darkness, we have electricity now, but in evolutionary time, you know, 99.99% of it, we didn't have that. So you really were in the dark. And I thought, gosh, you know, your hearing and your touch and all these things, those work just fine in the dark, but your vision is disadvantaged. The visual cortex is going to get taken over just by dint of the planet's rotation. And so dreaming appears to be a way of keeping the visual cortex defended every night. And the way that happens is with very specific circuitry. Every 90 minutes, you have these neurons in the midbrain start popping off, and they drive activity just into the visual cortex. But the point is, it appears to just be a defensive activation where it says, okay, look, it's nighttime, you're sleeping. We got to keep this thing active so it doesn't get taken over by its neighbors.
So in other words, if there was another planet that did not spin every day and have half of its day in darkness, then the creatures on that planet would not dream?
Exactly right. We dreamers might be a rare species in the universe.
Can I just say this is a very unromantic view of dreaming? That, you know, unlike dreams as sort of this window onto the unconscious, onto our souls, that you're saying, oh yeah, it's just, you know, keeping the visual cortex active.
You know, I sometimes seek romance, but mostly I'm just seeking truth. And so what we did, by the way, is we looked at all these species, for example, 25 species of primates, where there's data about how plastic their brains are and how much dream sleep, REM sleep, rapid eye movement sleep, they get at nighttime. And there's a perfect correlation there, which is to say, the more plastic, the more REM sleep you need. And by the way, REM sleep happens most in infants, because that's when their brains are really, really plastic and need to defend the visual cortex the most.
So I want to come back to your idea of the brain being live wired and how much it can change based on the circumstances or what the brain needs. There are some remarkable stories, for instance, of people who are missing half a brain.
Yeah.
One of their hemispheres, either they weren't born with it or it was removed surgically, and often they can live reasonably normal lives.
Yeah, absolutely. As long as a hemispherectomy, in other words, the removal of one hemisphere of the brain, as long as that's done before, let's say, 7 years old, a child is just fine. And I've interviewed and talked with several young adults who had hemispherectomies when they were younger, and you really wouldn't know it, except often what they have is a slight limp on the other side of their body where they're from where their hemisphere was removed. So what does this mean? What this means is that you can take out half of the brain and the functions that would have been, you know, taken care of by that half, just rewire onto the remaining half of the brain.
What are some of the most remarkable examples you've seen of senses that have kind of become rewired? People developed some new kind of sense or some unusual sense because they're missing the normal sense that we would have.
Yes, yes. So what got me really interested is, could we create new senses for humans? In other words, could you feed in some kind of data stream and would you develop an entirely new sense? And so many years ago in my lab, I started pursuing this. This is called sensory substitution. What we started with was doing this with individuals who are deaf because of whatever problem going on in their inner ear. They're not receiving any sound information. So what we did is we built a vest that's covered in vibratory motors, kind of like the buzzer in your cell phone. And the vest captures sound and turns the sound into patterns of vibration on the vest. The motors are arranged from low to high frequency, which is how your inner ear is arranged also. So we're essentially taking the inner ear and transferring it to the skin of the torso. And that worked. It turns out that people who are deaf can understand what is happening in the auditory world by getting the information through their skin, which is, in modern life, almost completely unused, but it's this incredible computational material that you can pass a lot of data through.
Why is the skin so good at that?
It's because it's developed to be very sensitive in case a fly lands on you or there's something crawling on you or things like that. And so it's actually got a pretty good bandwidth where you can pass a lot of data into it. And everybody's working on, hey, how can we pass more information into somebody's eyes by having, let's say, glasses with a heads-up display, or they wear an earbud and you're passing extra information in that way. But the fact is, your eyes and your ears, you really need for other things, and the skin is available.
So I'm just sort of trying to imagine what the future might hold for us. I mean, it's one thing if someone is deaf and can't hear and you have this kind of device that helps them navigate in the auditory world. But it sounds like there would be all kinds of possibilities to really augment, to jack up our sensory experience. I mean, we might have perfectly good senses, but they could be better or they could be different. They could be new. I mean, you're talking about potentially an entirely new world here.
Exactly right. And so the next thing that I got really interested in was sensory expansion. In other words, could you expand what you're seeing into the infrared or the ultraviolet? So we've built that. Just as an example, the first night that one of my engineers hooked up the infrared wristband, I was walking around in the dark between two houses, and suddenly I felt a bunch of buzzing on my wrist. And I thought, what is that? Why am I getting all this infrared light? So I followed my wrist straight to a nighttime security camera, which is surrounded with infrared LEDs. So it's lighting up the scene in a different part of the light frequency band. And normally that's completely invisible to us, but it was just obvious to me that it was there. And you can walk around, you can feel, you know, as you walk past a car, you can know if it just recently parked or if it was parked there a long time ago because the engine is hot. We walk by two seats and you can tell, oh, somebody sat there recently and somebody didn't sit on this chair. You get all this temperature information from the world, which is just an incredible new thing to tap into there. And then beyond sensory expansion is sensory addition. What if you add a completely new sense? So things like a direct perceptual experience of the stock market or of Twitter data or of the drone you're flying. So you're feeling pitch, yaw, roll, orientation, and heading all on your skin. It's like you've extended your skin up there to the drone. This is one of the experiments that we've done. So we have many, many experiments that are ongoing right now where we're looking at what happens if you have a completely new sense and can your brain come to have a new experience of this.
David Eagleman is a neuroscientist at Stanford University and the author of Livewired, the inside story of the ever-changing brain. And that was Steve Paulson talking with him. So if the brain is in constant flux and always responding to the changing world around us, maybe someday we'll look back at this time and talk about the COVID creativity boom, the pandemic, a cure for writer's block? Next. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. This hour, we're talking about the resilient brain and about how humans, as a species, are wired to respond to trauma. I think we're all wondering how this collective experience with COVID-19 will change us, not just this year or the year after, but for decades to come.
My impression is that this will be a cataclysmic event that will populate the collective imagination for many, many years to come. It will leave scars that centuries from now people will still refer to. It will manifest itself in movies, in music, in theater, in dance, in sculptures, on television, and of course in literature. It is very deep, and at the same time, it's externally embracing us all.
Ilan Stavins is a cultural critic and literary scholar. A few months ago, he put out a call to writers around the world, asking them to share what they've been thinking and writing about the pandemic. He's just published an anthology of COVID-related writing called And We Came Outside and Saw the Stars Again. The title is from the last line of Dante's Inferno, when the poet finally emerges from hell. Charles Monroe Kane, who says social isolation is his personal definition of hell, asks Stavins how he thinks everybody's doing.
What strikes me about this pandemic is that it comes just as we were having this ferocious debate on globalism. Does it matter? Should it last? Is it better to become more patriotic, more nationalistic, to close the borders, to build big walls, to cut away from our neighbors, to be only for ourselves? And ironically, it is the pandemic that has made us truly, truly global. We're all experiencing the same ways, having the same fears and similar dreams and similar reactions to nature and silence. So there is this quality in the anthology that makes it very clear where each of the writers is coming from in terms of culture, but also that there's something that goes beyond culture and that brings us all together.
You know, it's true. I have a lot of friends in New York, and things got really hard in New York, but I used to live in Prague and Amsterdam, and I have a lot of friends there. Everyone, they were doing their best. It makes me think about one of the people in your book, the American poet Jane Hirschfield, and she has a poem about saving an ant. Could you read that poem?
Of course. It's one of my favorite poems. Jane Hirschfield is an American writer, and she wrote this poem in Mill Valley, California. She dates it on March 7, of course, of 2020. The title of the poem is Today When I Could Do Nothing. It goes like this. Today when I could do nothing, I saved an ant. It must have come in with a morning paper, still being delivered to those who shelter in place. A morning paper is still an essential service. I am not an essential service. I have coffee and books, time, a garden, silence enough to fill cisterns. It must have first walked the morning paper as if loosened ink taking the shape of an ant. Then across the laptop computer, warm, then onto the back of a cushion. Small black ant alone crossing a navy cushion, moving steadily because that is what it could do. Set outside in the sun, it could have found again its nest. What den did I save? It did not look as if it was frightened, even while walking my hand, which moved it through swiftness and air. Ant alone, without companions, whose ant heart I could not fathom. How is your life? I wanted to ask. I lifted it, took it outside. This first day, when I could do nothing, contribute nothing beyond staying distant from my own kind, I did this.
It's beautiful. Actually, hearing you read it, I was just choked up. I totally get it. You have another poem that I love called Quarantine by the Irish poet Evian Bolin. I think we should point out here that she is no longer with us. She has died since she wrote the poem. Do you know if she was sick when she submitted this poem to you?
Evian Bolin, really an astonishing Irish poet, taught for many years at Stanford. And when Stanford decided to send everybody home, she went back to Dublin and was ready to start teaching remotely from there when she suffered a fatal heart attack. It was at the beginning of the pandemic. It felt as if the pandemic had pushed her to this end. I had seen her in Stanford very, very briefly, just a couple of months before. I had sent her a request to use this poem in the book, and it felt as if, when I read the news the next day, as if the world was really becoming smaller and poorer and colder, because to me, she was one of the most important voices of her generation.
Do you mind reading her poem?
Of course, with pleasure, and it would be an honor. It's called Quarantine. In the worst hour of the worst season, of the worst year of a whole people, a man set out from the workhouse with his wife. He was walking. They were both walking north. She was sick with famine fever and could not keep up. He lifted her and put her on his back. He walked like that west and west and north until at nightfall, under freezing stars, they arrived. In the morning, they were both found dead of cold, of hunger, of the toxins of a whole history. But her feet were held against his breastbone. The last heat of his flesh was his last gift to her. Let no love poem ever come to this threshold. There is no place here for the inexact praise of the easy graces and sensuality of the body. There is only time for this merciless inventory. Their death together in the winter of 1847. Also, what they suffered, how they lived, and what there is between a man and woman, and in which darkness it can best be proved. It's a beautiful poem.
Is, you know what? It's kind of perfect. It's a perfect poem. And I read it to my wife, and I was wondering when I read it, because of the gender, I put myself in the role of the man carrying the woman, but knowing my relationship with my wife, honestly, I'm the woman, you know, being mm-hmm. carried. And boy, that really hit home for how the pandemic was for me. It must have hit home for you when she passed. What was that like finding out?
It was very painful. And I because it's very painful, Charles, when you know somebody and you admire them, and then you know that their narrative is now over. There are no more poems that are going to come out from that person, that there is no more statement that is going to be made. When I read the news of Evan's death, there was one particular line of this poem that spoke to me so loudly, and that is the moment where it says that the last heat of his flesh was his last gift to her. It's just a little touch of his skin that is now turned by a poet into a gift, and a gift to send both of them into the next world. It is a beautiful poem about death, and it's a beautiful poem about love, but it's a restrained poem. It's a poem that doesn't want to overindulge in emotions, and it wants to simply show that in a pandemic, you sometimes have to escape. This happens 150, 170 years ago. The poem is written in 2008, but it refers to 1847. And yet you feel as if the couple could be just living right now. Somebody holding, embracing their father or their mother or their sister or their daughter for the last time before they are sent to a hospital or before they see them for the last time before they die.
You know, we've been talking about a lot of writers, and if you don't mind, I'd like to turn on you for a minute. How has this pandemic affected you?
This pandemic, in a bizarre way, Charles, has set me free. I have the impression that I have been so attuned to what is happening around me, and because of the moment in life in which I find myself, my children already placed in their own lives, deciding what they do with themselves, with my wife here. And at a moment coming close to 60, where I feel I have written or I have produced most of what I was set to do and not yet ready to say goodbye, I have all of a sudden the feeling that the pandemic has visited me and told me, all right, what is happening after now is a surplus. From here on, you don't have to be tied to the past. You have done what was expected from you. And now you can invent. Now you can improvise. Now you can be a kind of jazzy writer that even surprises himself by doing things that were never expected or planned. In some ways, I am thankful to the pandemic, to COVID. It has brought a kind of freedom that I am hoping to use in terms of mileage from this moment on.
I don't want to push you on that because it sounds kind of beautiful. You're liberated and free. But there are a lot of people out there, a lot of people out there, who this affected them. It was hell. And it still is hell.
Sure.
They're hungry. They're dying. How do you, as a creative person, also rub up against a person in Palestine who this is not a liberating experience for them?
Sure. And a person in Mexico City, and a right. person not too far from here in Brooklyn or in the Bronx, who, because she is a person of color, this has affected her in ways that are unfair and structurally racist. Yes, writers carry in their shoulders, on their shoulders, the burden of an entire culture, but writers also have to take a distance. I am very attuned to the moment in which we're living. I feel very empathetic and very connected and feel that my responsibility is to give voice to others, like this book that is allowing people to see what is happening in different parts of the world. But at the same time, I cannot ignore that there is also something deep that is happening in me and that is maybe happening in other people too, that the pandemic is inviting us to see the world under a different lens, with a different veil, so to speak.
The problem is, of course, is that this creativity, which is happening, it's amazing all around us, is coming out of trauma, right?
Yeah.
That's what's happening, you know, that the brain gets rewired as a response to trauma. And it reminds me of this argument of, like, you want to be a jazz great, you got to do heroin, and great poetry only came out of World War I. Is that really how this works, that out of struggle, out of pain, this creativity comes? Can't it come out of sunshine and love?
I think that creativity always comes out of pain, always comes out of trauma. And I think that's something that maybe the pandemic has elevated, but there is in many writers, I don't know, many of them will define it in many different ways, the feeling that what we are in, what our brain is in, is a race against death, against oblivion, in what we do here and now, through words, through paintings, through whatever strategies we have, is fight that oblivion, fight that that absence that ultimately we're all going to be about.
Elon Stavins is the editor of the anthology, and we came outside and saw the stars again. And that was Charles Monroe Kane talking with him. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced in Madison, Wisconsin at Wisconsin Public Radio by Shannon Henry Kleiber, Charles Monroe Kane, Angelo Bautista, and Mark Rickers. Our sound designer and technical director is Joe Hartke. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson, and I'm Ann Strange Champs. Stay well, and join us again next time.